In the next case, 2022-0654, in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Glover. On behalf of the appellant, Ms. Adams, it's my understanding that you two are sharing time with the State of Ohio.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to speak for 6 minutes and yield 6 minutes as well as the rebuttal time to Mr. Carney.
Thank you so much. You may proceed.
Thank you. Chief Justice Kennedy, may it please the court. I'd like to begin by starting with or emphasizing here what we agree on. And what we agree on is that the trial court in this case did in fact make the 29-29-14 consecutive sentencing findings.
Stop your hearing. When you say we, who's the we that you're referring to?
Defense as well as the State of Ohio. Yes. And secondly, we're in agreement that the standard of review for the appellate court in 2953.08 is not de novo. So with regard to the factors, I think this case presents this case, or this court, with an example that it's glaringly obvious that subsequent to Gwen 5, the Court of Appeals focused on the aggregate sentence and its entire analysis, the entire review process that it engaged in, was clouded by that focus on the aggregate sentence.
Okay, let me ask you about that. So if I have the facts correct, you have a terrible set of armed robberies, right? Convictions. The defendants offered a 15-year agreed sentence prior to trial, plea offer, is that correct?
There was a mention of, yes, a 15-year. Yes. I don't know the
that was rejected. He went to trial. He was convicted. And the trial court's parameters, discretionary parameters, were, as I read the sentencing transcript, between 12 and 154 years after making that decision that the judge believed consecutive sentences were justified under the statute in this case, required. That sound right?
That, yes,
between
roughly
12 and 154. Okay. And then what do you think guided the trial court judge in reaching that 60 number? I mean, because all of these separate crimes involved, they're all terrible, but various degrees of severity. But they were all 3-year gun spec, 7 years on the underlying crime, stacked up to the round number of 60. What do you think guided the trial court judge?
Well, I think we're aided by the fact that we don't have to guess here. The trial court did a very thorough sentencing hearing here. She utilized all of this was a bench trial. She utilized all the information that was gathered during that trial. She also obviously read the victim impact statements, considered all the statements that were provided by the investigating officers from both jurisdictions as well.
But even the investigating officer, they talked in terms of ballparks. And I know the state didn't ask for a particular sentence, but it was mentioned that after speaking with the victims and the detective that the ballpark of between 20 and 25 years would be appropriate for this.
As well as up to the maximum. And I
Why
think
didn't the state ask for the maximum of 154?
Well, I believe the record bears out that what the state's recommendation, if you will, here was to defer to what the victims request and leave that to the court to weigh that out, and which she the trial court did in this case, and very thoroughly. So we don't have to, we're not left with guessing at why those particular sentences were chosen.
Mr. Glover doesn't have an opportunity to seek during the 60-year sentence any type of parole, right? In the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation?
I believe that he would be eligible for judicial release. I think that's our...
After serving half of his sentence?
Correct.
So with such wide discretionary power, don't you think the legislature intended to have some check on that? Like, what? Or do you think we should hold as a court that appellate courts have no ability, unless they've got the math wrong in calculating, as long as it's within the statutory range, should we rule as a court that appellate courts have no ability to look at a record and say this sentence is just way out of the ballparks of everybody?
No, that's not what the General Assembly provided. Certainly the Court of Appeals has the ability to engage in a meaningful review of a consecutive sentence.
What did they do wrong here? They looked at a transcript in which the state mentioned the ballpark of 20 to 25 years. They modified the statute, the sentence to 25 years, just like the state asked for. What did the appeals court do wrong?
Well, I think the Court of Appeals did a lot of things wrong here, namely focusing, they almost fixated on the fact that in their opinion that this could potentially be a life sentence. And I think that clouded the rest of the review. And that was because they thought that they had to focus on the aggregate sentence. And also, I think
But when you said that they had to focus on, is it impermissible to look at aggregate sentence? So when a judge is imposing consecutive sentences and one of the factors is to protect the public, it's okay then to this, the total consecutive sentences here could have been 154 years. So the judge could have sentenced him to 154 years. And looking, and you don't think the appellate court could look at that aggregate sentence and say, 154 years. I don't think the findings support that.
No, I'm not saying that they can't consider that, but again, this was a focus and unable to really look at anything else.
But didn't they also look at the assumptions made about the juvenile, about the activities that happened when he was a juvenile and extrapolating violence onto that wasn't supported by the record?
Yes, that's an extra factor that the trial court. We don't need that extra factor in this case. I think it was completely permissible for the trial court to do that, but because we have the additional B, that was the focus here for the consecutive findings. And I really want this court to hear from Mr. Carney because he has some excellent points to make in this case. So I will yield the rest of my time.
One more question before you yield time to it.
Yes.
So. It seems, or let me ask you, does it seem odd to you that the state, through, I guess, your prosecutor's office, offered a 15-year plea, and here you're arguing before us today to affirm, instead of 15 years that you offered him, 60 years prison time?
First off, I don't know who made the offer. That's not borne out in the record. Second of all, I don't think it's...
You mean who, as in... State or defense?
Correct.
Okay.
And I don't think, obviously, that much more was learned, and I believe in State versus Rahab, this court talked about how much more is borne out in the course of a trial, as well as, you know, how the defendant is perceived throughout the trial, as well as, you know, through the sentencing. So. With that, I will yield the rest of my time to.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, and may it please the court.
Counsel,
let me get to something I was going to ask Counsel Adams about but didn't get to. The standard of review by the appellate court is an evidentiary standard of clear and convincing evidence, is it not?
Well, it's inverted clear and convincing evidence.
Right, unsupported.
Correct. And so I think there are two key points here that show how the trial court got it right and the appeals court got it wrong on Glover's consecutive sentences.
But
and that's
I have a
so
question
under
for you too.
Any of the court's opinions or frameworks.
So.
Well, wait a minute. Can you finish answering Justice Fisher's question first?
I thought he was done, and I.
Oh, I apologize. As I understand it, what the appeals court is supposed to do is review the whole record, and it even says to review, you know, the trial transcript, this whole sentencing hearing, and then ask, can you clearly and convincingly say that the evidence doesn't support the findings, not just the ultimate sentence, but the findings? And here, the appeals court plainly can't do that because, for starters, it misstated the state's recommendation. It stated that 20 to 25 minimum as if it were a maximum. And then it went ahead and said, you know, some consecutives would be viable here, but we're going to go ahead and knock it down to just 1 7-year sentence instead of 6. So that shows it substituted its judgment. It even said sentences that would have been reasonable we're still going to throw out. And that shows that whatever the standard is, the appeals court here stepped outside it.
Okay, so Mr. Carney, I know you have points you want to make, but sure. I really want to make sure this question gets answered. And that is that when the appellate court's reviewing, they're first looking at, and the trial court is imposing a sentence, they're looking at the appropriateness of consecutive sentences.
Sure.
So, number one, it's a two-part question. Is the court supposed to consider that in a vacuum? Because if they say, oh, here's 5 counts, you know, six years for each count, that's going to be 30 years. When they have to look at the other issues of its proportionality, its relativity to the interest in the sentencing statute, the findings that you make when you're imposing consecutive sentences, not necessarily needing a reason, but the findings themselves, don't you have to somehow say, oh, wait a minute, that's 30 years, or, oh, wait a minute, that's 60 years? Would that actually be right compared to the findings that I have to make? Would that make my findings credible? And so do you start with one consecutive sentence and then keep, you know, adding to see what turns out to be a reasonable sentence, or do you say, boom, consecutive, it's required to be consecutive in my book, but I'm going to start taking it down a little bit? So is it recursively additive or recursively subtracted?
Well, so, Your Honor, I think it's important to say what a trial court does in its head and what a trial court has to say under the statute.
But
I think
also
what the trial court here did.
But the trial court here did think
of it in terms of layers, because the trial court went out of its way to say, oh, you've got 11 felonies here. That gets you up to 3 to 11. So I do want to mention, by the way, the firearm specs, they're off the table. Your Honor, your opinion in the 8th District and James explains why specs are not part of it. So we're really not looking at those 18. We're looking at, you had 11 times 11, you had 121 at stake for the core felonies. And this judge went through blending, folding in all the 5 kidnappings, even after noting that these were real kidnappings. These were not just the retail robbery where you're restrained for 5 minutes, but these people were driven around for hours and put through terror. And so I think this court did go through explaining why that's not disproportionate, that despite those kidnappings being very real independent felonies, she still folded 5 of those in. And so as far as what the judge was thinking, did the judge articulate literally saying, well, when I come up to these 42 for 6 of the 7-year sentences, I'm rejecting 3 and 4 and 5, 7, 14, 21, 28. You don't have to write all that out and list, I'm rejecting 21, 28, or from the other end, I'm rejecting 49 to come at 42, but it's implicit. Just like if I say, I'll sell you this car for $15,000, not one penny less, I'm saying I would not sell for 12 or 13 or 14. So whatever requirement some view might have that you have to think of it in stacks, this court did it. So since this court satisfied that, there's really no reason to say, I think as one of the opinions said in the earlier version of Gwynn, a trial court knows what it's doing. A court doesn't just list these individual numbers and walk away to let a bailiff do the math. When she said at the end, so that makes 60,
So you're saying the trial court is considering the aggregate?
Well, I think a trial court is not considering it in the sense of stopping at every stair step, but they're certainly looking at the total and they're aware of what they did and they're saying, and this here is justified. And so I want to say really quickly, because I want to leave some rebuttal, what the appeals court did wrong is not only did it misstate, when the prosecutor said, on the one hand, minimum of 20 to 25, maximum of the true maximum, which would be up in 150 years, the appeals court flipped that around and said, oh, well, you were talking 20, 25 is a ceiling. No, that was a floor, not a ceiling. So whatever you do with an appellate record, you shouldn't be misstating the trial record. And then the appeals court said, you know, some stacks would be enough. But if you really think a trial court should build a stack like this, well, then an appeals court shouldn't say, oh, you went one step too far, so I'm throwing them all out and leaving just one seven-year sentence on the table. That's an abuse of the appellate court's power.
How does this court provide the lower courts, the appellate courts, and the trial courts with guidance that obviously Gwen 1, Gwen 2 has not done?
Right.
Like what well, should we rule?
I think in the end, however you phrase deference de novo and these statements that have a lot of baggage because the legislature did use them in a unique way here that's unlike any other area, so you can't say it's like other de novos or like other use of clear and convincing because it's inverted, is it might in the end come out like Fourth Amendment reasonableness cases, where you take enough cases where you say this search is good, this search is bad, and that narrows the room of disagreement. And that's why this case and the pending Jones case from the 8th District, which we argued when we didn't have the benefit of the newest win, they provide bookends, because one appeals court, the 8th, got it right. Here, the 1st District got it wrong. And if you explain that, and again, I don't want to do a disservice to the counsel in Jones. The court could always ask for supplemental briefing there if it wants to, but I think it has everything it needs. I don't think we need more, but you could. Is if you say, this is where an appeals court went too far. Just like appellate review is real and is to be brought in some outliers when they truly exist, here this appellate court was the outlier because it brought in factors that don't matter. I want to say briefly, I know I'm over time, but the comparative notion, everything about this statute says proportionality between this crime and this punishment, look at this offender. There is no warrant to say you have to do a spreadsheet of all the other robberies in the state in the last 5 years. After all, we don't have all those records before us. We don't have those PSIs before us. We don't have here the remorse where he, all those other cases, most of the ones they cite are guilty pleas. Here you've got someone rolling his eyes,
what denying. What about the overall purposes of felony sentencing in 29-29-11? I mean, that says that you're to treat similarly situated defendants with similar sentences. Does that not have any applicability to this?
Two things, Your Honor. First, this court said in Jones, in the 2020 Jones, that is not independently something that's brought to bear under C-4. It has limited, as Justice Fisher's concurrence in that case explained, has limited application for certain things like the racial discrimination, certain violations, but it's not part of the record view as a freestanding matter. And I think what the Assembly was doing there is saying that if everybody follows the standards in each case, that'll produce systemic more, it's like when you do a dance troupe, if you all follow the beat, you'll come out even with each other. But you don't look at each other and try to get in sync because then everything falls apart. Their comparatives, as we've detailed, show their guilty pleas, their crimes where they're quick retail, there's not kidnappings. They all, you can't try to mandate. You know, a court already has to show its work with findings. It doesn't have to show a spreadsheet of every comparable crime. So what the court can say to give guidance is you don't need to do that. And there's no cap. There's no cap on saying, oh, because you'll live this long, that means after you commit so many crimes, all the rest are free. What the judge here was doing is honoring each individual victim by saying each victim individually suffered as well as a community. And that's why this sentence is not an outlier from the trial court. It is an outlier what the appeals court did.
But there's no guidance in statute that says that every victim has to get some pound of flesh based on, I mean, that argument, what's that argument made on? It's to protect the public, punish the offender, set him on a course towards rehabilitation, if that's possible, and using the least amount of resources, of our limited resource, to get there.
Well, it says to reflect the seriousness of the offense or protect the public. So those two are listed as an or in that one prong. And in the seriousness of the offense, I want to keep in mind, there's a paragraph I really like, Justice Bruner, paragraph 91 in your latest Gwynn opinion, where it says that a wise judge is exercising the conscience of the community. And here, this just wasn't these several individuals who were terrorized for hours. This was an entire community that was terrorized in the summer of 2020 as the spree was going on. And so to say, after this first crime, all the rest don't matter and the rest of the harm doesn't suffer, that is not reflecting the conscience of the community and what the community suffered. What the appeals court did is not meeting the purpose of the sentencing. The trial judge was very much channeling what the court meant to do. If you look at any other case, again, here, he got a discount. He got 42 out of 121. Knocking that down to just 7 is not what appeals courts are meant to do, and this court should reverse that. Thank you.
Good morning, Ms. Burrows.
Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy, members of the court. May it please the court. We ask this court to affirm the First District. I'd like to slow the discussion down a little bit. And first, I would like to start, there is agreement between the parties here. One critical piece of agreement is both sides agree that 2953-08-G2, the appellate review statute, should result in deference. We offer different reasoning, but I think the result is the same. I think the disagreement is about how much deference is owed. And I think the root of that disagreement is that the parties interpret this statutory language differently. The record does not support the sentencing court's findings. Mr. Glover believes that that language means what it says. The record, if the appellate court clearly and convincingly finds that the record, lacks support for the trial court's findings, the appellate court must intervene.
So what deference is given in that instance? Where's the deference that you agreed to given by the reviewing court?
Your Honor, I think the best way to explain how this interpretation would work is with an example. So if the court would bear with me, and I'd like to take the simple example of Mr. Glover's juvenile adjudication. Again, the trial court inferred from that adjudication, which was briefly described in the PSI, that Mr. Glover had a history of violent criminal conduct. The PSI contained only
Let me ask you about that, because the trial court, I looked at the PSI says this offense, it doesn't give a statutory number. The Court of Appeals assumed it was a certain offense. Where did that come from? Because that wasn't in the record that I saw.
That the Court of Appeals assumed that it was a certain offense?
Right, the Court of Appeals says this is a violation of Toledo Municipal Code.
I think that the Court of Appeals...
The only thing the PSI said was safe school assault, Lucas County, Ohio, assault on teachers, disposition, 1 year probation.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the Court of Appeals understood that what I consider to be ambiguous statement in the PSI, the assault on teachers portion that you just read, that is the first half of the full title of Toledo Ordinance 537.16. And so I think just like the trial court, the appellate court was faced with an ambiguous record. But under Mr. Glover's standard of review, that ambiguity plays out different ways compared to the state standard of review.
I mean, there are other statutes that could have been as well, right? There's a state statute deals with assault on teachers. I mean, I was curious if there's any basis for the trial court to make, or the Court of Appeals to make that statement?
I think the Court of Appeals review was that the trial court could not have made that assumption. Your Honor seems to be placing the burden on the, or criticizing the appellate court for making that assumption.
Well, that's not what the Court of Appeals said, but we can leave that alone. But I'm also curious.
But can you go back and answer my question first, if you can remember it?
Yes, Justice Stewart, I do remember your question. I'll try to make my example brief. So using that prior adjudication, a review under Mr. Glover's standard would do what we've just been discussing. So it would ask, does this PSI clearly and convincingly support the finding or not support the finding? The Court of Appeals noted two things. First, that PSI contains no facts about the adjudication. And second, the ordinance in question seems to be one that involves both violent and nonviolent conduct. And when we don't know what happened and we do know that that ordinance could possibly criminalize nonviolent conduct, the appellate court basically found that the trial court made too many inferences on inferences. Let's change the facts a little bit to show how deference would work. Let's say the PSI did include a statement of facts, and these were the facts. Mr. Glover and another student were in a shouting match in a school hallway, and a teacher stepped between them to de-escalate the situation. Mr. Glover, in response, shoved the teacher. I think there the appellate court would have to defer, because there we're not talking...
Defer what?
Defer to the trial court's interpretation of what that incident means. I think different judges would look at that incident and draw different inferences. Some might say Mr. Glover is a violent, reactive person, and some might say he's a teenage boy, and this is not something that marks his character for the rest of his life. But that sort of disagreement is not enough to meet the statute's clear and convincing standard.
Are you making the argument that the First District did a clear and convincing evidentiary analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. Just with regard to this particular example,
To the case. In the case, is it your position that the First District did a clear and convincing evidentiary analysis?
Yes, I believe that the court cited the right standard. I think the question gets at our...
I didn't say, did they do the analysis? I understand what the standard is.
Yes, Your Honor. I think if you would have patience with me for just one moment, okay. I do want to answer your question. I think the question raises a procedural problem in this case. And the procedural problem is this court has only accepted review on the question of whether the consecutive sentencing statute requires consideration of the aggregate term. I think what happened below is the First District interpreted the seriousness and dangerousness elements of the consecutive sentencing statute. And it's possible that this court may well disagree with the First District's legal assessment of what seriousness and dangerousness looks like in a case and how to quantify those things. But so if you assume, though, that the First District got it right on the law, then yes, I think the First District did the same analysis that I've just described. It looked at this record and the trial court's findings, not any other findings, just the ones made by the trial court, on serious and dangerousness. It reviewed the evidence reviewed by the trial court, which was the number of offenses, the number of victims, the emotional harm described in the victim impact statement, the length of the offenses, and the adjudication and lack of remorse. It listed those things, and it found none of those things involved physical harm, so categorically...
As a matter of law.
Yes.
That's my problem. Clear and convincing is an evidentiary standard, factually.
Yes, and just like every other burden of proof and every other evidentiary standard, you do still need to know what the legal elements a jury or a court is supposed to be finding. And I think the disconnect in this case is the First District thought the legal element to be found required a showing of serious physical harm, and the trial court had a different understanding of the legal element. But I don't know that I think we need to be careful to separate that problem from the issue of appellate review. I think the appellate review statute is plain. And I caution the court not to allow its disagreement with the consecutive sentencing statute interpretation to color its interpretation of appellate review.
Well, I want to go back to what I started asking you about before, because you referenced this court finding about the juvenile adjudication. What the Court of Appeals said was the trial court found that Glover's adjudication was an act of violence, showing he was not amenable to follow the law and demonstrating a need to protect the public. The Court of Appeals said that, but that's not what the trial court said, was it? The Court of Appeals did not, or the trial court did not point to the juvenile adjudication as showing he wasn't amenable to follow the law.
I do think, Your Honor, it's correct to describe the record as the juvenile adjudication being just one small part.
But the Court of Appeals said he wasn't amenable to follow the law because of the obstruction of official business charge. I mean, the trial court said that, right?
So the trial court, yes, it stated that. It made the observation about the juvenile history. It never drew sort of direct connections between these factual observations and the statutory requirements. So I think the appellate court did what almost all appellate courts do when it comes to consecutive findings, consecutive sentencing findings, which is they kind of construe the record to best fit the statute.
Well, but in this case, the appellate court said the trial court said things it just didn't say, right? I mean, it kind of misrepresented, at least was pretty sloppy with the record.
Your Honor, the Solicitor General also sort of criticized Mr. Glover's briefing for sort of reiterating the same mistakes, having made those mistakes. I do think that these sort of nuances about how to construe the record are not obvious. I would not agree with the description that the First District was sloppy.
Excuse me, I'm reading from the record right here, page 563 of the transcript. And the trial court judge said, I feel that you do have a criminal history which shows violence in school. And I do feel that I need to protect the public. And I do feel it's necessary to protect the public and punish the offender, and it is not proportionate to the seriousness of the offender's conduct. So that was directly linked in the same paragraph, the school incident.
But it wasn't linked to the amenability finding, which is what the Court of Appeals said.
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I don't recall specifically the portion of the Court of Appeals that you're citing. I do not believe there's any sort of amenability finding, at least explicitly, in the consecutive sentencing statute. Justice Donnelly, I can understand why you read the record that way. Those things are in the same paragraphs. Not until this moment did I sort of understand them as directly connected to those two findings. I was reading the trial court to be sort of conducting a hybrid final assessment of the facts that were described above, and then also making sure to state the statutory findings more as a matter of making a complete record. But I understand that interpretation of the record.
Let me ask you what I asked your friend on the other side. How do we guide the courts of appeals who have been struggling with this issue? Like, do we have any ability to modify a sentence? What does that modification mean? That word in the statute.
Yes, Your Honor. The statute is plainly written. It says once the appellate court reaches this bar, a high bar, it has the authority to make the decision on whether to modify, reduce, increase a sentence. The question of how the statute's written with the word may, so it seems to invest appellate courts with total discretion to decide what's appropriate, how to remand, how to modify. I think the question of how to quantify the sentence, again, is just not properly before the court today.
Well, does that have anything to do then with the aggregation, the aggregate sentence, which, you know, there's debate about whether the trial court should even consider the aggregate, but we have, you know, language that says, well, it's virtually, I won't say this is the language, but in essentially saying it's impossible not to think about what the aggregate sentence is. So how does that come to play in this? How does that work?
Yes, Your Honor. So I think that the consecutive sentencing statute's second finding creates a formula. And this case, a disproportionality analysis, and on every disproportionality analysis, you need to know on what's on one side and what's on the other side of the analysis. And this case is only about what's on the first side of the analysis. The word disproportionate's plain and ordinary meaning requires an assessment of a part as compared to the whole. This case is about the part. And we understand the plain language of 2929.14c4, specifically the word not disproportionate and the phrase consecutive sentences to just plainly mean that trial courts are to consider and appellate courts are to consider the actually imposed aggregate consecutive sentence, which is not just the prison terms involved in a case, whether they're concurrent or consecutive, whether they're mandatory or non-mandatory, all of those things are true, but it's also any other penalty imposed in a case, gun specification, prison sentences, like the ones involved in this case, any fines, any other penalty imposed under 2929.14-18. And I get that from the statutory definition of the word sentence and sanction. The word sentence is defined as any sanction or combination of sanctions. And the word sanction is defined in 2929.01-DD as including any penalty imposed pursuant to any provision of section 2929.14-18. The consecutive sentencing statute uses the word sentence in its plural form. I think it incorporates those definitions, and to give it its plain meaning, you have to construe them as requiring consideration of the aggregate term, or the aggregate sentence, which includes all terms, all penalties imposed pursuant to those sections.
Do you know who, how the 15-year deal came about, which side?
Your Honor, my reading of the record is that the state of Ohio and the investigating officers worked carefully with the victims in this case to figure out what would and would not be tolerable to their sense of justice and their needs to feel vindicated for the harm that was done to them. And so again, I've construed this record to mean that offer originated with the state, but given some of the points of discussion here today, I can't assert with certainty that is true. It's just how I read the record.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Could you just go back to kind of the point you were making before, that the judge is required to consider the totality of the all the consecutive sentences, including the specs, et cetera. Isn't there an indication that the judge did that here? I mean, the judge didn't run everything consecutive. The judge, as the state points out, ran some sentences consecutive, but didn't do the maximum range for those. So, I mean, why would we think the judge didn't do that here?
Your Honor, I think there's a solid piece of evidence in the record. It appears in the sentencing transcript at 562. I'm just going to quote it for the court. The trial court said the sentences are consecutive to each other because one sentence is really not sufficient for the crime that you committed. I think at best this is an ambiguous record, but I actually think that that's a pretty plain statement by the trial court that it did not consider the aggregate term. It asked whether one sentence would be sufficient to meet the requirements, and it found that it
was. The judge didn't make everything consecutive, though. So I mean, clearly the judge had to consider the entire sentence.
Your Honor, there's a statement by the trial court in which the judge expresses some ambivalence about whether the kidnappings and the robberies would merge. I don't think that issue is before the court today, but again, I read the record to indicate the trial court wanted to make sure that this case was over for the victims at the end of that sentencing hearing. And so I think it sentenced Mr. Glover to an amount of time that no matter which way you slice it, he's likely to die in prison, and that makes his sentence sort of appeal-proof. That's how I read the trial court's statements on the question of kidnapping merger with aggravated robbery.
But was it appropriate for the court to start out with, my total, sir, is 60 years? I mean, do you read the record that the judge had 60 years in mind and then computed how to get there? I mean, if you're doing consecutive sentencing, your first question is, do I sentence consecutively? And then the question is, which ones do I stack? And you kind of look reflectively at where the overall term is getting to be, deal with proportionality, and then settle in someplace. Did you read the record that she basically came in with 60 years in mind and then delineated how she got there?
I read the record. I don't feel comfortable drawing that inference from the record, Justice Bruner, although I don't think it's an unreasonable one. I read the record to reflect that the trial court found that for each individual instance, 10 years was appropriate, and then it let the chips fall as they may, and it resulted in 60 years.
So again, that was more consecutive in a vacuum.
Say that again?
Consecutive in a vacuum.
Yes, that's how I read the record.
Then why was every count 3 and then 7? How come there wasn't very, because some of these had more egregious facts than others.
Yeah, exactly, Justice Donnelly. I think that the trial court was overlooking those nuances, had 5 individuals and 6 incidents in front of her, and off the cuff sort of assessed those all as, you know, on the whole, this person seems like a serious enough and dangerous enough offender to require 10 years per offense. And I do think it gets back to your point earlier, Justice Donnelly, about a pound of flesh. And I am so sorry, Chief Justice, I see that I'm well over my time, if I could just finish this remark. The state of the law before SB 2 was that the only maximum threshold on consecutive sentences was the number of convictions. That was the law before 1996. The law now is 29-29-14-C4, which I think sets the upper threshold for consecutive sentences not just based on the raw number of offenses, but on the substantive standards in that statute. And so this statute has to mean something different than the law that we had before. For these reasons, we'd ask the court to affirm the First District. The First District properly applied both of these statutes. Thank you.
Mr. Kearney. Over time, but I'll give you a minute to wrap up.
I appreciate the minute. I'll try to just very briefly address the juvenile court red herring and the physical harm issue. I do want to say I appreciate my friend on the other side for what I think was a concession about the appeals court being mistaken about this recommendation and that there is some deference here. The juvenile issue, it is interesting about how much it turns on the facts versus the amenability. Ultimately, it falls away because the court independently found, and this is shown in the sentencing entry as well as the in the hearing, that on the third prong, where you have 3 options, A, B, and C, the court found B, that the harm caused was so great to adequately reflect the seriousness, et cetera, and then also found the juvenile. So even if you throw out the juvenile, you're still there on B. That's an independent finding on 3 optional prongs. On the physical harm, the appeals court, aside from the appeals court putting a lot of weight on the mistaken recommendation notion, the appeals court really put a whole lot in the idea of, well, no one was physically harmed here, and there are 2 important things to know about that. One, the basic idea here of saying an aggravated robbery with a gun in your face and the threat of death is similar to a rape, that's the legislative choice to make those both F1s instead of saying, oh, that's only an F2 or only an F3. You could say in even a non-consecutive case, why is it fair that this rape on 3 to 11 got 5 years and this ag robbery got 9 years out of the 3 to 11 range? And the answer is because that's where the legislature put it. The legislature equated those and said it is violent to have a gun in your face. And that's where what this court did a very careful job. And what I encourage the court to do is not only read the entire sentencing transcript, but when it gets to the part about talking about the victims and saying this wasn't just a couple minutes you were restrained, you were driven around for hours and told at any minute, you know, I'll kill you if you do the wrong move, is set a timer and read and think about an entire hour of the gun to this young co-ed's head or to this guy who was victimized twice and was developmentally delayed. Set that timer for that hour, imagine that entire hour, and then read the appeals court line that says they suffered no physical harm, and do that recursively, and do that by each iteration of read that for the next victim, no physical harm, the next victim, no physical harm. If you do that, I think you'll reverse here. Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will receive a decision from the court.